This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
He might be enmired in legal cases, but Donald Trump is way ahead in the polling for who'll be the Republican candidate in the next US presidential election to be held 13 months from now. And in both the last two elections, whatever might have been the result of the popular vote, the outcome has been decided by mere tens of thousands of votes in a handful of states. In other words, Trump too is a real possibility. It matters to Americans if he's re-elected or not, but it may matter even more to some of America's allies and adversaries, to NATO, Taiwan and Ukraine, and to China and Russia. So what might a Trump presidency, commencing in January 2025, mean for the rest of us? And what can we do to prepare for this eventuality? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's remind ourselves of what happened the first time round. To take us on a tour of Trump's foreign policy during his presidency, I'm joined from Virginia by Anthony Zerker, the BBC's North America correspondent. Anthony Zerker, can you remind us how Trump pitched his foreign policy in the lead-up to the 2016 election?
You know, I was covering Donald Trump and his campaign in 2015 and 2016 when he first started running. And I was at one of his, what was billed as a key foreign policy speech here in Washington, D.C. And one of the things he repeatedly highlighted in that speech was that he wanted to have an unpredictable foreign policy, that he didn't want to foreign adversaries and even allies to be able to necessarily know what direction he was coming from and be able to adjust to it, that he wanted to be able to be flexible, that he wanted to be able to make deals but not be limited by stated positions and kind of entrenched beliefs. And that was his selling point. He pitched himself as the ultimate negotiator. That was something that he talked about time and time again, pointing towards his career in business, where he said he was able to negotiate big, beautiful deals, and that he would do the same thing when it came to foreign policy. He criticized the current and past U.S. foreign policy as being too weak. He said that the United States was being taken advantage of time and time again, not only by competitors and adversaries, but also by allies, and that in foreign policy, he was going to put America first.
After he was actually elected, how did America First manifest itself in what he actually started to do?
Well, you know, one of the things he came into the presidency believing what, or having, was a general distrust of international institutions and multilateral relationships. So for Donald Trump, America First meant more direct one-on-one negotiations with countries where He would be able to develop a rapport, a connection with foreign leaders, and then sit down and reach a deal that, in his view, was to the benefit of the United States. I think he viewed international institutions as full of bureaucrats and much more difficult to work with and much more difficult for the United States to dominate and kind of exert its raw economic, military prestige power with. And so he tended to focus more on, say, one-on-one dealings with European allies, one-on-one dealings with Kim Jong-un in North Korea or Vladimir Putin in Russia or Xi Jinping in China. It was the personal touch for him.
Now, that suggests right from the beginning that there was going to be a more difficult relationship than in the past with an organization like NATO. Was there a more difficult relationship?
Oh, absolutely. He went to Europe and attended NATO meetings and immediately rubbed European leaders the wrong way because he talked in such a blunt sort of fashion about what the United States did and what European allies supposedly didn't do, that the United States was being taken advantage of because it was spending so much more on defense and that European allies had to step forward and commit more of their GDP to defense spending. That kind of directness, that kind of bluntness definitely caused friction.
Let's look at some of the consequences or some of the ways in which these one-to-ones developed. And let's look first at how Trump's relationship with China developed during the course of his presidency.
Yeah, that's a really good example of what Donald Trump tried to do with one-on-one relationships and really the limits of that. I mean, it was kind of a love-hate relationship. It started with love. If you remember, Xi Jinping, Donald Trump invited him and the Chinese delegation to his palatial resort, Club Mar-a-Lago. And he did try to develop this kind of personal relationship, the Chinese leader, and use that in order to strengthen the United States' hand. But then he pursued policies, particularly trade policies, that created tensions with China. He began putting tariffs on Chinese imports because he viewed Chinese imports as undermining domestic industries, domestic manufacturing. And then, of course, when COVID hit in 2020, that also drastically increased tensions between the United States and China because Donald Trump began increasingly blaming China for the COVID pandemic, accusing China of covering it up, calling it the China virus and the Kung flu and things like that. So U.S. relations with China may have started on strong footing, but they went downhill over the course of his 4 years and ended at a pretty low point by the time he left office.
Now, the Trump presidency bridged the period between the Russian takeover of Crimea in 2014 and the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022. It was for kind of half that period. What was Trump's attitude, policy towards Putin, and how did that differ from what had gone before?
When Barack Obama came into the presidency and Hillary Clinton was his Secretary of State, she very famously talked about a reset in U.S.-Russia relations. Of course, that all did fall apart with the conflict in Georgia as well as the invasion in Ukraine. So when Donald Trump came in, U.S.-Russia relations weren't good. But Donald Trump, from the very beginning, had a more positive attitude towards Vladimir Putin, and that was demonstrated in the sit-down summits that Russia had, culminating in the summit in Helsinki, Finland, where they had hours of meetings behind closed doors. They came out and stood side by side, and Donald Trump quite famously said he trusted Vladimir Putin when Putin said that they did not interfere in the 2016 U.S. presidential election and had no reason not to believe Putin over even the conclusions of his own national security and intelligence apparatus. It was an interesting relationship and one that I think Donald Trump definitely tried to strengthen. And you have to also look at where the right wing in the United States is. And there are a lot of conservatives that view Russia kind of as a kindred spirit or kind of religious ethno-nationalist state that is doing battle with the forces of liberal cultural elitism corrupting the United States and other Western democracies.
Anthony, one of the things that is rather striking, if you look at what people have said since Trump was in power who worked for him, is it turns out that quite a lot of the people who worked for him in the foreign policy area and security area didn't agree with him and weren't really quite doing what he told them to do. How are we to read that in terms of that first term?
Donald Trump did bring in national security people and foreign policy people, as you mentioned, who had a different or differing viewpoint that were more kind of grounded in the existing establishment. He brought them in thinking that they were going to be, yes, sir, I'll follow your orders, I'll give you advice, but then I'll follow your commands. And that was not the way the civilian structure in the United States necessarily always works. And when Donald Trump was making policy recommendations or calling for actions that they vehemently disagreed with, that is why they found ways to either undermine or to soften some of Donald Trump's more inflammatory or provocative actions. And then in foreign policy, sometimes he brought in people that he saw on TV or people who impressed him as having very strong, very confident viewpoints. John Bolton, who is a foreign policy hawk, who he brought in as his national security advisor. That's another good example of someone who probably didn't exactly mesh with Donald Trump's stated foreign policy views. But Donald Trump saw him on Fox News a lot, admired him, thought he would be good in the position, brought him in. And then, you know, they clashed from very early on and was ultimately run out of the White House with Donald Trump souring on him fairly quickly.
Anthony Zerka. And if you want a weekly fix of US politics, you can hear Anthony and the rest of the team on the Americast podcast that's available on BBC Sounds. Now, before we talk about the security implications of a Trump victory, let's look at the economic ones, and specifically trade. Joining me to discuss that is Inu Manak, a fellow for trade policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, who is down the line from Washington. Inu Manak, how would you summarize Trump's trade policy whilst he was in office?
Well, the Trump administration reoriented U.S. trade policy towards a very zero-sum view of foreign economic relations, where any concessions that the United States made were seen as weaknesses, and Trump's U.S. trade representative, Robert Lighthizer, set out to correct some of these perceived imbalances by trying to extract some concessions from other countries while raising some U.S. barriers to trade. And he did this by using unilateral trade actions, sort of by dusting off these U.S. Cold War era statutes that applied tariffs on China, and then also applied tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, mostly from our allies for some alleged national security reasons. And then we also had some negotiated trade agreements that reduced access to the U.S. market or led to some one-way opening. And then finally, the Trump administration weakened multilateral trade institutions, particularly by going after the World Trade Organization.
So essentially, it was directed by an immediate sense of American interests rather than, if you like, a longer term and multilateral notion of interests.
Absolutely. I think that Trump's trade policy was really driven by this feeling that the United States had to be put first, that the United States was declining, that there was this sense that we could not compete with the rest of the world. And in order to reorient this, we had to basically pursue a trade policy where U.S. actions came first and everyone else came second.
Now, what was the actual impact on the U.S. economy and global relations over 4 years of that approach?
Well, Trump's trade policy not only had negative economic consequences at home, but it also injected a lot of uncertainty in our relationships with our closest allies. In the U.S., American businesses and consumers paid the cost of really high tariffs. Products from China that were hit with 25% tariffs saw drops in imports, and trade was diverted to other countries. And then for the products that Americans buy that they then transform into other things that they sell, those are intermediate goods, those became more expensive. And so U.S. companies had to seek out more expensive sources for imports, which raised their prices and led some companies to lay off their workers. And then we know what happened abroad, too. The United States turned the international trading system sort of into the Wild West. Here, the United States weaponized various trade tools to extract concessions from our trading partners and engage in ad hoc trade policymaking that left everyone on their toes. So there was a lot of frayed relationships and reduced trust in institutions.
Now, despite what you're saying, some of these policies were maintained under the Biden administration, weren't they?
Absolutely. You know, the Biden administration has maintained Trump administration's tariffs, and it continues to defend them in U.S. courts. And this is despite the fact that research shows that they have harmed the U.S. economy and failed to achieve their primary objectives.
Right. Now, let's look forward then. What has Trump promised or hinted at doing in a second presidential term so far in the area of trade?
Well, if you've been listening to Trump on the campaign trail, he's been boasting a lot about his trade policy successes in the past, and he's suggesting that he would do much more if he were reelected. One main proposal that he's floated is to impose an across-the-board 10% tariff on all imports into the United States. That would apply regardless of where it's coming from. And this would certainly raise costs for U.S. consumers and businesses and hurt low-income families the most. I think that the largest cost of this policy would come from the global fallout. Our trading partners would likely retaliate with tariffs of their own, and a tit-for-tat trade war at this scale could spark the demise of the World Trade Organization that really undergirds all our international trading rules. So I think that Trump could get away with doing this. Potentially, his former trade representative, Bob Lighthizer, has supported the idea of increasing tariffs, and he could do so under the exact same authority that he used to launch the trade war with China. And I think he would use similar tactics and use those tariffs as a way to threaten other countries to negotiate some concessions, and we would see a scramble for countries to get exemptions. At the end, I think this would distort international markets and just cause a lot of uncertainty in the trading system.
Let's look at the rivalry of China. You've already pointed out that President Biden has continued with most of the things that Donald Trump did. Does that mean that Donald Trump will outbid Biden if he's president and try to go even further than he has done before, or that this time he'll actually temper it a bit?
I wouldn't say he'd ever be temperate. I would say that the anti-China rhetoric is certainly going to heat up under Trump. The question for me is whether he will do anything substantive with it. I mean, I wouldn't rule anything out. At the same time, even if Trump takes a more blunt approach to China, let's say adds more tariffs, he may not be as effective as what the Biden administration has done with much more targeted sanctions. So China is likely to welcome, I think, a second Trump term, not least because it would lead to greater tension among U.S. allies and potentially weaken cooperative efforts that the Biden administration has nurtured in the Indo-Pacific, specifically with Korea, Japan, and Vietnam. So I think, we still don't know what's going to happen here, but I believe that there's going to be a lot more heated China bashing going forward.
I have to say, some of that sounds quite counterintuitive, the idea that China would welcome a president who sounds like he's bashing them more.
Yes, absolutely. I think it does sound counterintuitive, but at the end of the day, I think Trump's bark is louder than his bite. And so for that reason, I think China would probably welcome his return.
Now, are there any current Biden trade deals being negotiated that could be discontinued?
Almost everything the Biden administration is negotiating right now would be affected by Trump's return to office. So at the moment, some of our allies are scrambling to secure deals with the Biden administration out of fear that Trump will return. But let's remember that Biden hasn't pursued a traditional trade policy, and he hasn't sought authorization from Congress to negotiate any of the trade deals that he is working on. What this means is that most of the deals that he's negotiating can be thrown out by the next administration with the stroke of a pen. So this means things like these critical minerals deals that we've been negotiating with Japan and are continuing to negotiate with the European Union, these would be entirely meaningless without Congress backing them. President Trump could just tear them up.
Inu Marnock. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about HS2, the one about the effects of Airbnbs, and if you want more Trump, the two about his ongoing legal woes. Finally, I want to explore what the diplomatic, political and security implications of a second Trump term might be for the rest of the world. Joining me in the briefing room to discuss that are Elizabeth Saunders, professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and Sir Lawrence Freedman, emeritus professor of war studies at King's College London. Elizabeth Saunders, let's talk about the scenario in which, in whatever kind of way it is, in January 2025, the inauguration is of Donald Trump. Who do you think will be directing his foreign policy? Who will be around him?
It's important to note that I don't think he has to be inaugurated in January of 2025 or win the 2024 election in order to have a major effect on U.S. foreign policy. So in some sense, the effects are already being felt now. It is important for European capitals to be thinking in terms of continuity with the Biden administration, but it's also the case that not only do they have to think about the possibility that Trump might win, but they have to think about the possibility that another Republican might win. And it's very clear that Trump's hold on the party has taken so much root that the isolationism that is increasing in the Republican Party is the mainstream dominant GOP view, which is a historical, and it's really quite different from the history that we're all familiar with in the post-World War II era. This is not the Republican Party that most politicians will be familiar with, or most European publics will be familiar with. Anyone who remembers Reagan and Thatcher, staunch, you know, anti-communists, the Republican Party was the party of standing up to the Soviet Union. And that strain of isolationism is not new. It was ascendant as recently as 1950s, and it's come and gone. But only with Trump did that wing of the party achieve the biggest prize, which is the presidency. And the president has not only tremendous power to set the agenda in foreign policy, but also brings along other members of his party and the people around the party. And I think the fact that you've seen Mitch McConnell, one of the last of the old school geopolitical internationalist hawks, that used to be the mainstream, and now he is really fighting a rearguard action in his own party. He's the Senate Republican leader, of course. And you will not be seeing politics that we've come to expect, no matter who wins in 2024, I think.
Now, Laurie, having heard all that, let's switch over, let's say, to people in NATO, European allies and so on, listening to that kind of analysis. And they call you in and they say, Laurie, how should we begin to approach this possibility? What should we actually do, and how should we begin to think about our strategy?
I think you have to remember that the US bureaucracy, the deep state, as it were, is internationalist. And will be at odds and will drag its feet on the sort of characters that Trump may bring in, assuming he can find them. Anybody with any experience of working for Trump knows that you tend to come off worse as a consequence, whatever your ideological leanings. But let's assume that he finds them. I think the first reaction of NATO countries and other allies will be to give them a chance to see what they have to say, to listen to see if there's any room for maneuver, anything to cling on to. And then they have to start making some pretty big decisions, because the whole security apparatus of the Western world depends on the United States. Extract it, and you're left with some pretty big and complicated decisions. In Europe, for example, my presumption is that Putin is pretty desperate to hang on to see if Trump can win. And so immediately you'll have a crisis over Ukraine. It's unavoidable. There's going to have to be some pretty hard rethinks on issues like that. But I say in the first instance, they'll try not to panic, but see if there's found a way of engaging with the new administration.
Okay, it's great not to panic, Laurie.
I think they should panic.
I think in private they can panic, but in public that would be the wrong, because that would excite Trump and just give him more to work with. I think they've got to dare him to be responsible.
Elizabeth Saunders, is there any possibility at all that even under a Trump presidency, America will say, no, don't want to be in NATO anymore?
Oh, I think Trump has made no secret of his desire to, if he wins a second term, to withdraw the U.S. from NATO. And, you know, there's all sorts of nuances in terms of that I can't speak to, and you'd have to get an international lawyer to answer about whether he can actually do that from a sort of treaty perspective. But it doesn't really matter, because the fundamental underpinnings of NATO is American military power. I think the problem for the Europeans is, it is true that the American administrative state, civil service, is internationalist in view. But every year that passes that the never Trump Republicans are not, or the sort of like internationalist wing of the party is not in power, diminishes the pool of those political appointees that could have that internationalist outlook and give the civil service its direction. And so if you get a Trump 2.0, you will have the political appointees attempting to either sideline or fire in en masse, which is something they've talked about, the civil servants who provide that institutional memory and that ballast against radical change. And there just isn't a cohort of people on the Republican side to replace them and come in. And you know, the pool of people in the internationalist wing is shrinking. So I think if I were in NATO and attempting to game this out, I would try to imagine a February 2025 crisis over Ukraine under Donald Trump, in which Trump has already said, I want to withdraw from NATO.
Let's talk about China, because both Donald Trump and to a certain extent Joe Biden have looked at China as being the foremost challenge to America. Joe Biden might add climate change to that list. If I were Xi Jinping, how should I prepare for a Trump presidency?
There have been indications from China that they'd quite like it, mainly because quite happy to see chaos in the United States, and it would conform to their narrative that only wise leadership and President Xi guarantees stability and a long-term prosperity. I think the China issue in some ways goes against the wholly isolationist tone, because there are a lot of people, including some who worked for Trump in the first term, were, while down on Ukraine, not that interested in Europe, do see the challenge with China as something defining and something that has to be addressed. So while you wouldn't be very internationalist looking across the Atlantic, you might be still quite engaged looking across the Pacific. And then you need allies again. And I think, you know, the problem for any American administration, it's not just the allies need the US. The US, the things they want to do, need allies. And he didn't particularly manage the Japanese and the South Koreans well last time. So, you know,
he also wants to end those alliances too.
Yeah, in which case you'll find it difficult to deal with the Chinese.
Well, Elizabeth, I would like your take on this point. Last week, we talked about Canada's problems with India, and one of the constraints which we realised people told us was on India was that it did require allies in its rivalry with China. India did. And what Laurie is saying is the same, actually. Of course, the United States is more powerful, would be true of the United States. Do you see that acting as a reasonable constraint?
In U.S. political commentary, you often hear this, well, in China policy, Trump and Biden are really not that different, right? They both are, you know, Biden kept the tariffs and so forth. But I think this is really where the invisible parts of foreign policy and national security policy come into play. So much is done by people whose names I don't know, and I follow foreign policy and national security closely, right? This is all done. This is spade work. It's not headline grabbing. And the Biden administration, whatever one thinks of its policies, excels at this. And that sort of invisible spade work that goes into any achievement in foreign policy is not something Trump has ever been interested in. And so I think the combination of his willingness to just blow things up, metaphorically speaking, in terms of alliances and ask the Japanese and the South Koreans to pay for our protection and all of that, and his lack of value on, he doesn't place much value on that kind of diplomatic spade work. I think it's going to be very tough for a Trump 2.0 administration to have any sort of trust on the part of U.S. allies. They, too, will have to prepare for it that day.
Laurie, the kind of diplomatic approach which Elizabeth has described is almost the polar opposite of that which is usually talked about when we come to talk about British diplomacy. We're going to have our own general election around the time of the American presidential election, could lead to a new prime minister. How much do you think that the time of that new prime minister, if there is a new one, is going to be taken up worrying about what's happening in the White House?
Oh, a lot. Pretty obvious that in the run-up to the 2020 election, a lot of effort went in Downing Street in trying to work out how to show the Biden administration, or in a potential Biden administration, that the UK would be good allies. It would be the other way around, potentially, this time. And I think all that could be done was that you would use every bit of diplomatic clout you had in Washington to try to meet people who you thought would be influential. The difficulty we keep on coming back to is Trump's own personality. He's not interested. He's lazy. He's impetuous. He's narcissistic. All these things make it very hard, even for people who think they know his mind, who think they're following his policies, to do so with consistency. So it'll be an odd thing that this is British general election is unlikely to be much about foreign policy at all. Yet, as soon as it's over, the big issue will be who's going to win the American presidential election.
Our election is also not going to be about foreign policy, but that's where I think one of the biggest impacts will be, actually, because the president has so much power in foreign policy compared to domestic policy.
Elizabeth Saunders there with Lawrence Friedman. My thanks to them and to Anthony Zerker and Inu Marnock. The Briefing Room will be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Sally Abrahams and Claire Bowes. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by James Beard. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Have you ever wondered who you really are?
It clicked in my mind suddenly. I was like, why have I never done this?
I'm Jenny Kleeman, a writer and journalist. In my new series, The Gift, from BBC Radio 4, I've been uncovering extraordinary truths that emerge when people take at-home DNA tests.
He said, what do you know? You don't even know that your father's black.
So I'm like, Jeff, we got him. And he's like, what are you talking about? And I go, we got him.
Obviously, it was completely unintended consequence of a gift.
Join me as I investigate what happens when genealogy, technology, and identity collide. Listen to The Gift on BBC Sounds.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.